This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Now, are you born and raised in Minnesota?
No, I was born in Texas.
Oh, nice. When did you arrive in Minnesota?
When I was a kid, sometime like 8 or 4, sometime early, I don't know.
Wow. But you pretty much, when people ask you, you pretty much say, I'm from Minnesota. I'm not from Texas.
I normally would say I'm from Texas.
Yeah.
I think it's just more interesting, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And what do you do this full time, or do you also have like a full time job that you do?
I used to do this full time for a while, but I started trying other things. So I have like 5 jobs right now.
How is managing that? Is it tough?
Not really. I don't think so.
Are you able to say, you know, what are some of the other things that you're juggling right now?
OnlyFans, Pornhub. No, my main job would probably be chess coaching. I do chess coaching for 2 different companies. So I do about 12 schools a week or something. So like 1 or 2 before school starts and then like 1 or 2 after every day or more or less. Then I do Jimmy John's bike delivery from 10 to 2. It's my like stay in shape job. YouTube stool donation for 2 different companies. It's the best job probably. And ad reps for my car, probably. I think those are the main ones.
The chess coaching, what age groups is that?
K through 12.
Okay. Wow. Is it mostly men, or is it girls and women too?
Mostly men, I think. I think when you get into the much younger groups, it's more even, but mostly men.
Any like child prodigies that you have under your wing?
Yeah, I had one student at a school who is the same rank I am. So he was like 8th grade, and my rank on Lee Chess and chess.com is like 2200. He's the same rank.
And for context, for somebody like me who doesn't really know rankings, 2200, that's very premier.
I think so, yeah. I think like 2000 and above is when you're considered like very good.
And are these mostly done, or the competitions, or if somebody's that you're coaching going through competitions, are these in person or are these done online?
In person. So I like go to the schools and teach classes of like 30 kids.
And when maybe like when you yourself, if you're in chess matches, do you mostly do them in person? Do you mostly compete in person?
No, because competing pays very poorly.
Yeah.
So I only play online for fun.
I gotta imagine too that competing online is a different feel than competing in person.
Probably, because online I don't actually do the competitions. I just play ranked matches pretty much. And so it's just public play against other people kind of a thing. Playing in the ranked matches takes a lot of time and effort, and it's not worth the payout. So I just play for fun mostly. And while waiting for class to start or something, I'll play while at the coffee shop.
If you were to tell somebody, maybe like me, who I don't really play chess, you know, the one or two things that you could do right now to get better at chess, what would you say?
I just teach you the rules. So like the, other than just the rules of the game, there's like the rules of the beginning, pawns to the center, get all the knights and bishops to the center castle, first three rules. Middle game rules are like, check the opponent's closest piece first and the opponent's longest range piece, and look at all their pieces before you look at your pieces. Stuff like that. And rules of checkmate, build a wall, keep the wall, create another wall.
Is that what maybe some might say, like just the basics?
Yes. Sort of. So like, they are the basics in one sense, and then when you start getting good at it, they become less basic. So like the middle game rules, check the opponent's closest pieces and longest range pieces. What you're checking for changes as you get better. And when you start to learn all the different complicated things, you start checking for more stuff. And so in that sense, it, the same rules can be very complicated if they get built upon.
Currently at home, do you have very nice chess sets that you, that you've collected or something like that?
No.
Yeah.
I think the nicest one I have was my high school chess set, because I was on the high school team. Mm-hmm. But I never use it or touch it. The nice things I've collected are Yu-Gi-Oh cards. I have like $10,000 in Pokemon cards, $10,000 in Yu-Gi-Oh cards.
You and I might be like around the same age then, because I grew up with Pokemon, Yu-Gi-Oh as well.
I'm 4,000. What about you?
4,000?
Yeah, give or take.
Oh, in age? Oh. That's actually, I guess we are very different in age, I guess.
Would have been better if you said, I guess we were exactly the same age. Like, amazing. Did you meet Yoda? Like, yeah, he was a great guy.
I want to give you a proper introduction really quick. So, hey, everybody out there. My name is Chris. This is Chitash. And today we have a very special guest on the podcast, content creator, debater, T-Jump, Tom Jump. Thank you very much for joining me today. Please introduce yourself or add in anything in addition to that introduction.
I'm T-Jump. I like potatoes.
Nice. So I know we've been talking about some of the other things that you do, but where I first came across your content was on a debate video on Modern Day Debate, which is a YouTube channel out there that hosts different debates. And I saw you on there, I think, debating some sort of religious topic, and thought, wow, this is pretty cool, making a lot of great points and putting on a very good performance. When did you first start doing these debates?
7 or 8 years ago, I guess. Started having conversations with professors in coffee shops, mostly as a way to practice conversation in a setting that didn't trigger my anxiety too much.
And I've heard you actually mention in a couple of your videos about anxiety and depression. Is that something that has been a struggle for you for a lot of your life?
Yep, my entire life.
Yeah.
Probably the biggest struggle. Mm.
Would you say currently or presently that it's gotten better over the years?
Yes. So my depression has gotten better, but the cause hasn't.
I know for myself, I know I struggled with anxiety for a few years, and yeah, definitely that's something that's not fun to deal with. Would you say, do debates or content creation, does that help with anxiety or depression?
No, it was mostly just a thing I tried as a way to try to get used to talking to people, because it used to be the case that talking to anyone ever for any reason caused me a significant amount of anxiety. And so I did YouTube and online conversations as a easy way, safe space way to have conversations that were less emotionally exhausting. And in that way, they helped, and that I got it became more used to conversation and talking to people and building social skills. But ultimately, it didn't really work to help with the depression.
Now, you mentioned professors that you've had conversations with. Now, your educational background, did you attend university, get postgraduate degrees?
I started going to college for computer science, but I started my YouTube channel at about the same time, and the YouTube channel became more successful. And because I had depression and anxiety, and going to school was mentally and emotionally exhausting, and so I didn't get anything out of it. So I pursued growing my YouTube channel and dropped out of going to college. Because I was wasting money and wasn't helping at all with achieving more social skills.
That's really interesting. I'm actually in my day job. I'm a software developer, although I didn't, that is not what I got my degree in. I actually attended a coding boot camp, if you're familiar with those. And it's funny, I've interviewed and talked to other software engineers, and there's kind of a debate right now. I guess maybe there's always been a debate. Hey, do you need a degree to do things in your career? I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, especially in computer science. Do you feel like a degree is necessary to become a developer or software engineer?
Well, a degree isn't necessary for anything. The point of the degree is to demonstrate a certain level or pedigree of ability to do a lot of busy work, follow orders, follow schedules. Most of what college and high school are is just a training ground to know that you are a reliable employee, not to know that you actually have the skills to do the job. That's just like a secondary thing. And so school does show that you can follow rules and follow orders and complete tasks in a timely manner. And that's kind of the point. And so the vast majority of the stuff you probably learned in school, you probably never use and you probably never will use. And so really, it's not about giving people the skills to do the job. It's giving people the skills to be obedient workers.
Do you remember going back to your YouTube channel when you were first starting it? What were those first few videos like, or what were they about?
Conversations with professors. So it was like Rick Mattson and David Clark, I think, were the two like first ones I had conversations with, and Blake Jenta maybe. So it was just conversations on the philosophical arguments for gods. That was the same stuff I normally do.
Is that, did that eventually lead to you debating these professors or people like these professors?
Well, the conversations were technically debates. They only got into like formal debates later, but they were still just always debates.
Early on, when you first started doing them versus, debates that you do in this current time, are they very different as far as, your how you debate your opponents or the energy or the tone of the debates?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. I think the earlier debates were very intellectual and respectful, and so a lot of the debates are like that. But like the debates on Moderate Debate aren't like that at all. A lot of dumpster fires. And so when it comes to debating professors and people who are very intelligent and intellectual, yeah, they're about the same. When it comes to like the dumpster fires and the flat earth debates, those are a relatively newer thing.
How did you first get connected with other debate platforms like a modern day debate?
I don't remember. It was just probably one of us emailing saying, "Do you want to debate?" I was like, "Sure." I think the first person who like raised awareness of my channel was Pine Creek. He was the first one to like invite me on his channel to do interviews and stuff. So I think he was the one who first got me a lot of traction and growing.
And does your approach to debating, does it differ whether you are on your channel versus if you go on somebody else's platform?
Not really.
As far as things that you might bring up or points that you make, they're essentially the same between your channel versus others?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I think it depends more on who I'm debating rather than the platform. Because like the quality of the debater and how smart they are.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
What they're able to understand will progress the topic to more meaningful avenues, which will be unique to debating them versus dumpster fires.
Now, was there ever a point where you were doing debates in person, or have they always been online?
Yeah, I've done a bunch in person. So I did the first one in person was probably Modern Day Debates in Wisconsin with Steven from Hellenistic Christendom. And then I think I've done 3 or 4 debate cons with Modern Day Debate. I did a debate with the Bible and Beer Consortium in Texas. With the skeptics in Georgia. I did a speech at the Black Nonbelievers in Mexico on a cruise. I'm doing one in person here in Minnesota on the 17th. And I'm going to Australia and doing a lecture at a Christian conference in November 26th or something.
When you first started doing debates, or maybe like the first debate that you did in person, was that pre-COVID or was that after COVID?
Probably pre-COVID. I think it was like 4 or 5 years ago. Maybe more.
Was there a time period where maybe you would have done more debates in person, but then COVID kind of derailed things and now you kind of do them, a lot of them online?
Not really, because a lot of the debates would happen in like Texas where there weren't any shutdowns anyway, so no one really cared.
Prior to this, like when you were younger or in school, did you participate in any like school debate teams?
No. In school, I did just chess and football very rarely because I was too severely depressed and unable to speak to anybody to have any other kinds of interaction. So I didn't really have much interaction in grade school or high school or college.
Is it very different than what you participate in today?
Yeah, the formal school debates are garbage. They mostly are based on a very formal structure, like Lincoln Douglas style, where you have very strict guidelines and resources and how you're graded based on point making. And it really isn't very productive for convincing anybody ever about anything. It's just a rehearsal in dance, more or less. It's just, expressing ideas in a way that tickles the fancy of the judges, and that's it. Really doesn't have any value to actually convincing people or discussing any serious topics that matter or making any progress on those topics. It's completely just irrelevant. The debates online, informal debates like Hitchens and Harris and Harris and Dawkins and Dennett, the ones they did, and the kind of the ones I do on debates, have more of a productive impact on helping people to move their understanding of a topic forward and relate it to their everyday life. And so it's much more productive in the online sphere than the academic sphere.
The format that you mainly participate in, can you describe what that is like, and, you know, between, you know, how much time you get and if it's an open platform or if you're only speaking and then the other person speaks, etc.?
It's mostly just open dialogue. So we have a conversation about a point. My style is to ask whoever I'm talking to, like, what's the most important or best argument that you have, focusing on the topics they know the most about, they're the most interested in, and having a discussion centered around that topic and what they think is the most important aspect, and focusing on one thing at a time. Doesn't really matter who talks more or how often. It's just as long as we can clearly articulate our positions to one another and we can understand one another's position or rebuttal, and then be able to respond to that rebuttal in a way that the other person understands. That's what makes a great debate, that can actually progress intellectual ideas.
Presidential or vice presidential debates, is that just a completely different format, and that's like a completely different beast than what you do?
Yeah, that's like another complete waste of time. That's even more of a waste of time than the academic debates. They're a complete joke. Like, they don't even answer the question. Like, at least in academic debates, you're graded if you answer the question. Like, that's important. Like, if you don't answer the question, you get docked points. In political debates, you literally can't answer the question. Your goal is to not answer the question. They ask you a question, and it's just an opportunity for you to spout out your own talking points to make your base happy and to try to get more people who are aligned with your base to agree with you. And it really has nothing to do with answering the actual question. I don't care at all. So yeah, political debates are a complete waste of time.
Going back to the debates that you participate in, how important is it? How important is time? Like, do you find that if you get more time or you're speaking more than the other person, you have more time to kind of get your points across and make the better argument? Or do you find the opposite is true, or it doesn't really have any correlation?
It depends. It's more about being able to express your ideas clearly and efficiently. So like Pine Creek actually counted out how much time I speak versus how much time the professors speak in our conversations. And it was like, I speak only 10 to 15% of the time and the professor speaks 80% of the time, but I'm usually destroying them in the debate because my points are clear, easier to understand. And so it's really winning the debate is more about how clearly and concisely you can express ideas in a way that is understandable. And then the percentage of time you get doesn't really make a difference.
How often do you feel like you've won a debate? Is it after every debate you finish, do you always feel like I came across as the victor?
For the most part, there are several that I lost and did bad in. There are many where I was presented a new idea that I hadn't heard before. That's a very good idea. Like my first debate with Randall Rouser, where he presented like fallibilism to me. That was a new idea that was, I didn't know about, and learning more about it, it was a very good point that he made. And so he won that debate. Another one would be like, I think, I don't remember if this was before my YouTube career or not, but I was discussing infallibility, knowing with absolute certainty. And it's a part of fallibilism that you don't need absolute certainty to have knowledge. That's the position of what fallibilism is. And understanding that you don't, for something to be evidence, you don't need to disprove the alternative. I don't remember what that's called, but something can be evidence of a position, even if it's also evidence of all the other positions. And that was another interesting position to learn about that's very meaningful.
Do you place any stock in maybe what other people or how other people view how the debate went. So maybe you could feel like I had the best debate ever and I did really, really well. But then maybe you look at the comment section or if there's a chat window that's going and people are just not on your side. Has that ever happened?
Oh yeah. When you go on dumpster fires, like the kill stream with Jay Dyer, that happens all the time. It's not meaningful at all.
And so in the debate, are you trying to change the audience's mind?
Indirectly, yes. The goal is to have positions that are compelling enough to be able to change a certain percentage of the audience, but it's like a single digit percentage. Changing a single digit percentage of the audience in a debate is actually massively huge. It's an extremely high success rate. Politicians dream of that success rate. So in a way, yes, the goal is to make arguments that do that. But my direct goal is just to make the most successful, compelling, easy to understand arguments.
Now, do you ever find in a debate or after a debate, have you changed your opponent's mind?
Yes, many people have. Like one of them that comes to mind first is one of my debates with a professor on alternatives for God, and I brought up a naturalistic particle, like a quantum particle that could create the universe as a necessary being. He's like, I never heard that before. I'll add that into my next book. Like, that's cool. And so there have been a number of occasions where professors have said, oh, I've never heard that argument before. That's a really good argument. I don't know if I fundamentally like made them an atheist. That I don't think has ever happened, but I have introduced new ideas to them that they had never heard before that they thought were very interesting. So in that way, yes.
Now, I've heard you describe yourself as an atheist. Is that correct?
Yep.
Has anybody you have debated ever given you a good reason or changed your mind about God or religion?
No.
And currently, I have heard that you have actually started a church as well.
Yes, that would be one of my goals, is to grow, take my model of morality and build it into a religion alternative to Christianity. That would be really cool.
Mm-hmm. Currently, as it is today, is it there's currently service, or it's currently like providing functions for people?
Right now, it's just the live stream on Sundays. That's about it.
Oh, nice. Do a lot of people attend or go to live stream?
Back when I was doing it seriously, it was like 200 to 300 per show, but I've been just uploading old content for a while now. I had lost motivation to really keep doing new conversations every day. Mm. So since then it's gone down a lot.
But has it been difficult, or is it difficult starting something like that, like a church, that is?
No. Have you been to any Western state in the United States? There's one in every corner. It's not difficult at all.
What are the most common topics that you debate?
Evidence for God is the biggest one. I say there is none. Somebody else says there is. And whatever argument that they center around is usually the topic. So that's usually the most common one.
Are there any debates where you've only, are there any debate topics where you've only done like one debate on?
Sure. I did one where I was a Christian debating that God does exist, and against Samuel Masson, who was pretending to be the atheist. So I've done a lot of niche debates like that.
Oh, that's interesting. So now, in that specific debate, like, was that difficult for you to take the opposing side?
No, that's one of the things that's good about academic debate, is that they require you, they don't tell you what side of the debate you're on, that you have to prepare for both sides. And so it's a requirement that you understand the opponent's position as well as your own. That's something that's a very good thing about academic debate. And so from my position, I'm always trying to do my best to understand both sides of the position very well. So it was not very difficult to try to take the alternative position.
In that particular debate, do you feel like you came away victorious?
In so far as that I presented a better case for Christianity than he did for atheism, probably.
But not enough to convince yourself to switch.
Yeah. No.
Do your tactics or maybe what you present change based on like these mini subtopics of what I would call religion, like existence of God, the truthfulness of the Bible, etc.? Can you like plug and play different arguments no matter what top subtopic of religion you come across?
Probably. So the way I interpret that question is to say that I wrote an epistemology, a theory of knowledge, which can assess what certain claims are and what kind of evidence is required for those claims. And so that epistemology can be applied to all of the different arguments for God universally. And I can start from a basis of using that epistemology in order to answer any argument that comes up for the existence of God.
And by epistemology, what exactly does that mean?
Epistemology is the study of knowledge. And so an epistemology is a formal method in order to establish what knowledge is. Like justified true belief is the contemporary definition of knowledge. And what counts as a justification would be your epistemology. So eyewitness testimony could be evidence of something, or empirical evidence could be evidence or something, or shaking a magic eight ball could be evidence of something. And your standard of whatever qualifies something as evidence is your epistemology.
In the topic around
hiring, isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/arts. Just go to Indeed.com/arts right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/arts. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Found the existence of God. What are like the common themes that you bring up for in favor of your side across your debates with different people? Or are there common things that you bring up with your opponents?
Sure. So like Jesus drawn babies, it's a great line from Pine Creek. So like when talking about the morality of the Christian God, it does a complete inversion when you look at the patterns of morality when it comes to everything that we know about morality. So if you compare, for example, a power dynamic, the person who's in a more powerful state abusing their power to take advantage of less powerful people is always wrong, except when God does it. Or when a doctor is trying to heal you, if your doctor from the 1800s is trying to like save you from a gunshot wound, he cuts your leg off because that's the only thing he knows how to do. Whereas if a doctor today who has access to penicillin cuts your leg off, you'd sue him for malpractice. So the level of power the doctor has mitigates how much harm they can do to you unnecessarily. And if they do greater than necessary amounts of harm to you, that is immoral. And so a God with infinite power has some goal, save your soul or whatever. If he causes you more harm than necessary, that's immoral. But in the case of Christianity, it does a complete 180. He's allowed to do anything he wants to do, and it's totally fine because I'm a sky daddy. And so the biggest argument that I bring up in the case of morality is the complete inversion of moral trends and moral norms when it comes to this one God. It's just special pleading. Other things would be like responses to different arguments, the fine-tuning teleological, the cosmological, ontological, moral arguments, the responses to most of those all tie together in a number of different ways. Naturalism can provide equally or better solutions to all of those arguments. And so I'd like provide a naturalistic alternative, quantum field or a quantum particle that is the necessary being, and can that explain the origin of everything? Yes. Can I explain the fine-tuning? Definitely. The exact same way God does. So like I'll do the mirroring or stalking horse argument where they present an argument for God and say, well, God explains this in this way. And then I just copy that like a mirror and say, well, okay, well, the quantum field explains it in this way, which is like the exact same way. Problem solved. Now we have an equally as good explanation for the fine-tuning as you do for God, and you don't need a God for it, in order just to show that they're, what they perceive as evidence isn't really evidence at all.
Are these debates regarding the existence of God, are they mainly with people who identify as being a Christian?
Yeah, mainly. I've done Jews and Muslims and Latter-day Saints, Mormons, Hindus, all kinds of different religions, Black Hebrew Israelites, but mostly Christian.
And do you find, is there any sort of difference in the debate between if you are debating somebody who is a Christian versus, like you said, who's a Jew, who's a Muslim, who's a Mormon, etc.?
Yeah, Muslims specifically are about 400 or 500 years behind Christians in the level of their argumentation. So they're just objectively worse in so many ways. Maybe there's a few Muslim debaters who are much more qualified, but it seems like the vast majority of the popular Muslim debaters are just significantly behind in their knowledge of philosophy and science and everything, to the point where their arguments are the things that Christians were using 600 years ago. That would probably be the most common one. Obviously, Hindus have a different view on morality, and so you can't say they're God-drawn babies, because that's not a different book. They have different things in it. So there's clearly differences based on the per-religion basis. But when it comes to evidential claims, if their evidence is argumentation, like the fine-tuned argument, then yeah, they all get defeated in the same way.
And so your approach, no matter who you're, or what religion somebody is that you're debating in regards to the existence of God, your approach doesn't change.
Oh yeah, but my approach is essentially asking them what is the best evidence you have, and so that approach is never going to change, because it's essentially just asking for their position. Mm-hmm. And so it's not like I have a pre-written script or argument that I'm going to present no matter what the opponent says. I always ask them first what's the thing that they think is the most important.
I've also seen your debates regarding evolution, and I know that this is something that kind of gets tied into religion. And why do you think this belief or non-belief of evolution is so tied to like Christianity or religion, or do you think it is like very strongly linked? Like you, if you're a Christian, you don't believe in evolution.
Because in the Bible, it says humans were created from dirt from Adam, and woman was created from his rib, Eve. And so it wasn't billions of years of evolution from different species to humans. It was a much more direct process in the Bible. And so literal interpretations of that will give them the perceived belief that evolution must be false. And so it's pretty much exclusively a religious trend to deny evolution on the grounds of their book saying that it didn't happen.
Does that conversation change, or maybe does it change at all whether somebody's like Jewish or Muslim or Mormon or Hindu?
Yes. So like Hindus typically don't reject evolution. They don't have any reason to. Their books, the Bhagavad Gita, the Vedas, they doesn't say anything against evolution. It's very cryptic and non-direct. And so there's no reason to like think that because those books exist, evolution would be false. Saying evolution is false is pretty much exclusively a Christian and sometimes a Muslim thing, but mostly a Christian thing. Jews don't really care as much. Jews mostly don't take the Bible as seriously or as literally as the Christians do.
I actually have heard a debate, and I forget the gentleman's name that you were debating on Modern Day Debate, where your opponent actually was a Christian, but he believed in evolution, but he believed that it was the work of God, that God made evolution, basically. I forget the exact argument, but does your approach change in that sort of dynamic where somebody says, hey, I am a Christian, I believe in God, but God created animals and people to evolve?
Well, I mean, sure. Like, if someone believes in evolution, then I wouldn't try to argue for the truth of evolution since they already accept it. So I would usually, again, start by asking them, what do you think is the best evidence for God, and address what they pick. Whereas a creationist, someone who believes that evolution is false, would probably start with the fact that they think evolution is completely ridiculous. And so that's why the topic would center around the evolution conversation rather than going on to their other preferred arguments.
From listening to a few of your debates regarding evolution, I've heard you bring up DNA as like a big point that you make. And is that kind of the end-all, be-all argument that you would use in that sort of situation?
Sort of. So DNA on its own isn't really anything. It's the patterns in DNA, specifically the retrovirus ERVs, the endogenous retroviruses that inject their DNA into our DNA. And then when our DNA is replicated through cell division, for the very few cells that are like stem cells or like sperm cells or egg cells that get these ERVs to inject DNA into them, all of their offspring will have the same ERV marker at the exact same location. And none of their parents or brothers or sisters will have it. So all of their offspring will have it. All of their descendants will have it. None of their parents or siblings will have it, because the chances of an ERV injecting its DNA to the exact same spot, which it injects it at random locations along whatever 3 billion long base pair chain, is astronomically low. And so we can tell the relation between species and humans by looking at the patterns in the ERVs and telling, oh, well, this one is in this location for all of these animals, but not for these. Therefore, these must be more related. And that was something that was predicted before we knew it. And that's what I would focus on as real evidence, is the ability to predict something before we know it and get it right. If it's predicted before we know it based off of a hypothesis and then that discovered to be correct, that's evidence the hypothesis is true. That's the real evidence that I focus on for any given topic, is that novel prediction of new information based on a hypothesis is true evidence that the hypothesis is true.
As far as this topic, has any opponent that you've faced in this sphere of debating evolution, have they given you something that has given you pause or made you rethink your arguments as far as evolution?
Well, some of them have said things so insanely stupid that it gave me pause. Kent Hovind has accomplished this task a number of times. But none of their arguments, no. None of the creationist arguments are especially stupid. The ones that think evolution is false, they have to do so much mental gymnastics to try to make their arguments work. They're all just completely terrible. It's just the level of the terrible is astounding and awe-inspiring of how stupid they can be.
Let's say if you didn't use an argument centered around DNA and essentially what you had just mentioned, what other kind of big sticking points are there to prove to somebody or to show somebody that evolution is what happens and creationists are not correct?
Well, it's literally been observed. That's the big step. One of the biggest problems would be trying to address their misconceptions about information and their mislabeling of things. Like, they say that usable information or readable information can never come from random mutation that's just demonstrably false. Literally in the definition of information from information theory, from Claude Shannon's like 1958 paper where information theory was literally invented, it says information can be produced by a stochastic system. Stochastic literally means random. And so the fact that they think that random processes can't produce usable or readable information just shows that they have no idea about anything related to the topic of information. And so I would be focusing on trying to correct their misuse of the term information and finding the ways that it is, that they have changed it to mean something specifically related to their belief system that has nothing to do with the academic usage, while they're using that term to refer to both what they think it means and how they think that that same definition is applied in academia. And that would be one of the main lines of argumentation, other than novel predictions. But there's lots of examples of novel predictions other than DNA that I would go to, like fossil record, the different experiments where we've discovered like single cellular organisms going to multicellular organisms. It would also go to abiogenesis too, because they conflate the two, evolution and abiogenesis. So it's going to be a lot of debating the origin of RNA on clay, or the RNA world hypothesis, or how information can be produced by those things, just replicating without any intentional hand behind it.
Yeah, I know you mentioned Kent Hovind, and I've listened to a couple debates that you've had with Kent Hovind. And what you were just saying with information, does that address what I heard a bunch of times among your debates with them about adding, quote unquote, adding new information, and that evolution doesn't add new information? I forget exactly what he had said, but I don't know if you remember the exact context of that.
Yeah, that's mainly the argument. The argument is that random mutation can only destroy and never add new information. It's the there's a specific name for it. It's like entropy, something entropy, genetic entropy is what it's called. It's a creationist theory that mutations will always be detrimental and will never cause positive new traits to develop, which is just stupid. It's false. It's just objectively false. And they claim this based off of definitions. They've defined information in such a way that it requires intended purpose for why it was changed rather than randomly. And so they try to say that random mutation can't create new function, which is just false. We've literally observed it doing so, like going from a single cellular organism to a multicellular organism. We've observed that in the lab. That is a new function. We've observed tons of new functions happening all the time, and they're going to argue, well, it's not a new function. It's just an old function that was already there in the beginning that's been reactivated or some nonsense.
This is something else that I've heard in your debates on this topic about the difference between a prediction and a post-diction. And I was wondering if you can explain the difference between those two.
Yeah, so a post-diction is taking something we already seen and expect, and then saying, oh, the pattern that we already know will continue to happen. The sun will rise again tomorrow. Or, well, there's two parts to this. The first part is taking something somebody else predicted and then explaining it in your hypothesis. So if I predict we're going to discover a boson, the Higgs boson, in the Large Hadron Collider under these conditions with these numbers, and somebody else says, oh, but my hypothesis can explain that too by the magic leprechauns. That's a post-diction. You're taking the information we already see and making it fit your hypothesis. Anybody can do that. Not spectacular at all. No one cares. Prediction is when you can think that you're going to discover this thing before it's discovered, and it's an expected result of your hypothesis. So a prediction is an expected result of your hypothesis that we don't know yet. A post-diction is something that's already been discovered that you're making it fit into your hypothesis. So anybody can make anything fit into their hypothesis if we already know it. No one cares about that. The second thing is the explaining something or claiming that something we already know about is a prediction. So like cows come from cows. That's a prediction Kent Hovind makes. He's like, oh, well, cows will continue to come from cows. Like we've already seen them come from cows. That's not novel. There's nothing novel about that. So you're just taking the stuff we've already seen, the post part, and then inferring the post part will continue into the future, like the sun will rise tomorrow, which is not a novel prediction. It's a prediction, but not a novel prediction.
How has this topic of evolution changed over the course of scientific history? Like, for example, has evolutionary theory, or is evolutionary theory today a lot different than from when Charles Darwin first wrote Origin of Species?
I mean, yeah, he didn't know anything about DNA or pretty much any of the complex processes that we know about today. So he was essentially making the predictions about things that they would discover, knowing nothing about the field. And then since then, we've discovered them and then made new predictions that he couldn't even dream of and discovered those too.
His work, his books were still very relevant, or they're still very needed, very important in laying the foundation, I guess, for what we know today.
In a sense, like in a historical sense, they did lay the foundation. Is there any reason to actually read The Origin of Species? Any information that you couldn't get clear or better from other sources? No, you can just, like, you don't actually need to read The Origin of Species for anything. There's the current scientific textbooks would be better. But historically, yeah, it was the origin. So if you're looking at it for a history degree, yeah, you should probably read it.
Are there still things about evolution that we still need to know, or are there still things yet to be discovered or refined, or maybe we don't know what we don't know?
I mean, always, there's always stuff that still needs to be worked out. We have not come close to mapping out the entire process from going from non-life inorganic material to life organic material. So it's a huge thing. Biology and neurology are the two most complicated fields that have the most variables to combine. And we literally just don't have the time to test all the different various combinations. So it's going to be impossible for humans to even come close to mapping out and discovering all the different biochemical interactions within the body that lead to how the human body functions. We're going to need AI, which with much faster brain power than ours, to be able to start to decipher the true core of biology and neurology.
How important is it to discover this, like, quote unquote, like, what's it called? Like the common ancestor of, you know, humans and apes, or between, you know, whales and us? And is that like a very important thing that still would need to be discovered, or it doesn't really have any bearing on that topic?
Oh, we already discovered all that stuff. That stuff was discovered a long time ago.
Another topic that I've heard you debate is, I don't know what I would categorize it, like political systems. Capitalism versus Marxism, communism. Do you still have debates on those kind of lined up, or in the future, do you still take debates on those?
Well, if anyone pays me $50, I'll debate anything. I don't care. But I don't have any debates really planned other than the in-person ones coming up, because I just lost motivation to keep doing them.
You always take the side of capitalism, or does it depend on the question that's being asked?
Yeah, it'd probably depend on the question being asked. The most common debates are usually going to be pretty basic, like which is the better system for humanity or something, and then they'll probably take capitalism. Yeah.
How would the question be framed to where you would take the opposite, like you would advocate for communism or socialism?
What is the more moral system? What is the more equitable system? What is the one that has the more goal of equality? Like those moral utopian goals are the aspiration of utilitarianism, and or the aspiration of communism and Marxism is to try to make a more equitable society. It doesn't work. It's pragmatically fails, but the ideal is more moral than making, I forget what it's called, not Aquarian, Equestrian, the thing where we're all based, we get stuff equivalent to our skill set. Egalitarian. Mm-hmm. That's not a moral way to run society, whereas giving people what they need according to their needs is a much more moral way to run society. It just doesn't work.
Does it, the debate also change now if you're debating communism or socialism or Marxism? Does your approach change, whether it's any of those other or terms that you're debating?
Oh, it would depend on the topic.
Yeah.
It's like if the topic was, which is the most pragmatic system that encourages humans to function in an economically viable way, then it'd be the same. Just be showing that capitalism works mm-hmm. to motivate people, and socialism and communism, Marxism don't work to motivate people very well. But if it was on like the principles of the particular system, then I'd have to modify the debate topic to focus on the principles specific to whatever system they were advocating for.
How would you define those terms, especially like socialism, communism? I mean, we could even throw in there Marxism, Leninism, because I know for myself for a while, I kind of just my surface level knowledge, you kind of lump everything together, but would you say that those are all very distinct and very different things?
Sort of. So like they all branch off from Marxism, the books of Karl Marx. But and socialism and communism both overlap in that they are design systems around the ownership of the means of production relative to like the workers. So it's all based around that idea, and they have different implications at different levels. But as long as the topic is specifically focused around like efficacy, the pragmatic success of an idea or a political system, it would, that you could treat them identically. They wouldn't really make a difference. If you were actually going into the history and debating specific principles, they would have differences.
How difficult would it be to debate for those systems when you have something like the Soviet Union that collapsed, or, you know, you hear people say that, oh, these systems have never worked in reality? Does it make it harder to advocate for those systems?
Well, yeah, because the biggest factor when determining which economic or political system is the most beneficial is its success rate. That is the only relevant factor when establishing which system we should apply, is like, how often has it been tried and how often does it succeed? Capitalism works extremely well because it motivates people to become successful and then use that success in order to take advantage of other people, which is very good at motivating people to work. It is not very easy to motivate people to work when a lot of what you're doing will be given to other people and not yourself, because humans are selfish. And so because humans are selfish, and the track record of history shows that they're too selfish to get socialism or communism to function or to be a sufficient motivation for the majority of the populace to be successful entrepreneurs, yeah, that would be the biggest hurdle in trying to establish or debate for those positions being preferable to capitalism.
How would you define that term?
Private ownership of the means of production, more or less.
I heard in a debate that you did, I believe it was with a gentleman, Infrared, where you were debating on this topic, and there was some discussion around, you know, if having a company that, you know, was capitalist versus company that was communist, and, you know, if you really believed in this idea of communism, that then a company should be started around that system. And I was wondering if you could go into some detail on what like a communist company would look like.
Oh, there's a lot of them. They're called co-ops. It's companies that are literally owned by the workers, where you get a, become an employee and you get a share of the company, more or less. That's, there's lots of them. Yeah, many of them are very successful. They just don't, they're harder to run, they're slower, and they're less, people are less motivated to make them. If you have the option of creating a co-op with a bunch of friends where all of your workers are going to get a portion of the company, or you can create a company that you own all of it, and if it gets billions, you get to keep all the billions to yourself. People are like, I want the billions.
Or no company, let's say, in like the Fortune 500 kind of qualifies for that description, would you say?
There's a really big one, like Santoro or something. I don't remember, but there's a really big co-op that's extremely successful. They do exist. They are many success stories of co-ops that are extremely successful. The question isn't that it's impossible for them to be successful. The question is the success rate. When talking about political and economic systems, single digit percentages make a world of difference. Same with evolution. Like a single digit percentage of being stronger or faster or smarter, you conquer all of the other competitors. Same thing applies in economics. So even if there are successful models of socialist and communist companies, that's not what matters. What matters is, will implementing these systems have an increased several digit percentage rate than preferring or allowing capitalist companies? And the answer is no.
The origins of these ideas, going back to like the writings of Karl Marx, Frederick Engels, and kind of a similar question to what I asked you about Charles Darwin and Origin of Species, how have things changed a ton since those writings, you know, Das Kapital, Communist Manifesto, etc. You know, do we still need to read those books in order to, hey, if you really wanted to go out and start a co-op or start a country that was communist?
No. So all of the original documents have been replaced by newer updated documents. So like now we don't go for a strict capitalistic system. That isn't the best anymore. Now we go for a mixed economy where we do lots of social programs in addition to capitalist economic programs. And that's the most successful system. That's the one that's used in all of the successful Western countries. Not a strictly capitalistic system, but a mixed economy. And so, again, going biased off of the original text is usually never a good idea. There's usually no reason to ever, for anything, go off the original text when it comes to technology or science or the economy. There's usually newer stuff that's been worked better because people continue to try things and figure out new ways to improve it. The only time you go to the original would be like Harry Potter, fictional tales like the Bible.
What would be, I guess, like one example of maybe like a writer, author who has taken those ideas of Marx and Engels and kind of evolved them or tailored them for like a modern day, if you know of anybody?
Oh, God. Well, I know of some bad examples. I forget what it's called. The feminist one, the new feminist, feminist one based on the perceptions or, oh, I forget what it's called. The one that the Republicans all hate. I can't remember it off the top of my head. I know I've done some debates on it. I know mm-hmm. I have, but it's the one that's based on the principle of something about perspective, where you weight the perspective of the people who are affected by the policies more than the weight of academics or people who are experts in the field. Critical race theory. That's it. Critical race theory. That's the one. Mm. So yeah, critical race theory is based on like three founding principles that have been added to Marx's principles. And one of them is the, whatever the name of the principle was, about valuing the opinions of people affected by the lived experience of the people who are directly in the zone of the policies that is affected by them over the experts in the field. But yeah, so there's definitely people who have taken those ideas and modified them in a very bad way. Mm. I think that I don't know if the institutions of like healthcare, like the NHS in Great Britain or the globalized healthcare in all of the Western countries, I don't know if they were based off of work that started with any of the socialist or communist writers, but the idea fundamentally is similar in that it creates a more equitable society. And so they're called socialist policies, things that provide social welfare programs. And I don't know if any of those have any basis in socialism or Marxism, but the fundamental goal is the same. And so they're called or referred to as socialist policies.
Now, on that same token, if we look at capitalism and, you know, maybe somebody that equates to the level of like a Marx or Engels, maybe somebody might say would be like an Adam Smith. And to flip it over to that side, is there still any sort of importance laid out or any importance set to reading Adam Smith's work as far as if you want to be more knowledgeable on capitalism, or have there been other people's works since then that have kind of evolved the topic and made it better, especially for like a modern day?
Yeah, there definitely has. There was several very famous economists who have written on it. I forgot his name. He advocated for negative income tax. He was a big libertarian guy. I haven't researched economics in a while, but Milton Friedman, I think. I'm pretty sure it's Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman has written a lot about it, and he has a lot of really great ideas. He's considered to be super far right wing, except he advocates for a negative income tax, which is not at all right wing. It's very good. It's like a UBI. It's a Republican UBI. And so in the same vein, unless you just want a historical basis, there's no real pragmatic value for reading those except just laying groundwork for understanding the work of the newer guys, I guess. But you don't really need to. You don't need to at all.
One thing that might maybe come to people's minds as far as the staggering difference between the time that these gentlemen wrote in versus modern day, and maybe why there could maybe be a disconnect or a need to refresh the text with updated ideas. Somebody might say, oh, technology and, you know, computers, information.
Evidence. So the biggest thing is that we have more data, more ways to collect data, more experiments done on economies and countries and cities. And so we have just a vaster amount of data and time to process that data, which they didn't have. That's what matters, because that's what tells us which systems work and which systems don't work.
You had mentioned in one debate, or I forget if it was you or your opponent was in this topic, you were talking about China. Is China a completely communist country, or is this what you were talking about, that it's more mixed?
It depends on what you mean by completely communist. Like, if socialism or communism or Marxism were done in the way that they were intended, they would be probably pretty okay. The problem is that because humans are selfish, the people in control usually abuse the power to an overwhelming extent where they end up mass murdering lots of people. But that's not a part of communism. There's no like communism that says starve the bourgeoisie and kill them all. It doesn't exist. That is not a thing in Karl Marx writing, that we should just start murdering people. But it's a consequence of communism insofar that because people are selfish, they aren't motivated to adhere to the values of communism or socialism. And so in order to try to motivate them to abide by those rules, you're going to have to threaten them with guns and starvation and death. And if they start their own private economies, like the Bolsheviks or whatever. I forget. It's a B word that was in Russia. Then in order to stop them, because they're not motivated to adhere to the communist political system, you're going to have to shoot them or kill them or something. And that, so because communism doesn't motivate people to adhere to it voluntarily, you need someone in power with big guns to force people to adhere to it non-voluntarily, which leads to the regimes like China and Russia. And so would I say that they're purely communist in the puritanical sense that it's like real communism? Like, no. But I would say that they were the most likely outcome if you are trying to establish a communist country.
Earlier, you had mentioned other debate topics that you do, and you had mentioned some dumpster fires that you do. And is one of these topics, would you say, flat earth? Is that kind of one of those that falls into that category?
Yeah, usually that one and presuppositionalism are the two main ones.
Are those debates something that have been common that you've done, or have you kind of after a while, do you just stop doing them or partaking in them?
Well, I've stopped pretty much doing any debates for the most part, but yeah, they were very common for a while. I did them for views and stuff, but they didn't really have any intellectual value.
Mm-hmm. What do you find is like the biggest kind of difference between if you're debating somebody who's a flat earther versus if you're debating somebody who's, you know, the existence of God or creationism, etc.?
Well, with flat earthers, you're pretty much guaranteed that they're idiots. With Christians, there's lots of very intelligent Christians where you can debate and have a productive conversation of understanding the arguments and the different positions. With flat earthers, it's just going over a lot of meaningless facts that they misinterpret deliberately in order to try and support their worldview.
And is that the same thing with, I saw another debate that you did on the moon landing. Would that also kind of fall into that category?
Yeah. Alex Stein is nothing but a poser for views. Very successful. More successful than me. Got on Fox News. Freaking Fox News. That is, Alex Stein got on Fox News. It's ridiculous.
Because of the moon landing, or this was something separate?
Oh, something separate, but equally as stupid. He was going up to Congress and making equally as stupid claims about, I think it was abortions or something. And there was a clip of him and he got invited on Fox News with Tucker Carlson.
Or like that's your goal someday to get on a major network?
I would love to go on Tucker Carlson. But he has like 300,000 subscribers on YouTube right now.
Mm-hmm.
Alex Stein.
Going down that path, what is kind of your plans for the future and like your YouTube channel and debating? Do you have any like guests, special guests that are coming up or anything different that you're going to be doing?
Well, I have a live debate on the 17th at a church here. And then I have a presentation I'm giving to a Christian organization at a conference in Australia on like the 26th or something. But those are the only two things I have planned. I stopped planning things or working on my YouTube channel a while ago. It was not as successful at pursuing the goals I needed to try to overcome more of my depression. That's the focus.
Tom, this has been really awesome. We've done over an hour, and this has been very, very enlightening. I definitely have learned a ton. Thank you very much for doing this.
Sure. Anytime. Happy to help.
And for people who want to get in touch with you, I know you have the YouTube channel, but are there any other avenues for people to connect with you?
Yeah, just messaging me. I think my work email is listed on my YouTube channel, like tejump@comcast.net. You can also message me on Discord or Facebook or whatever. Those are the big ones. Mm-hmm. But unless you have a way to introduce me to stunningly gorgeous women, then I don't, then leave me alone. I'm working on this stuff.
Well, I'll include links to everything that you had just mentioned in the description of this episode for people to check out. And yeah, thanks very much for doing this again. Really enjoy your debates and really enjoy your style and your approach, and have learned a ton from watching your content. So thank you for that. And for everybody else out there, thank you very much for listening. My name is Chris. This has been Chitesh. Take care, everybody.